Mike Bernhard reporting for the Exascale Report. We're here today with Justin Ratner, CTO of Intel Corporation. Justin, thanks very much for taking the time to meet with us today. We really appreciate you taking the time from your schedule.
Oh, happy to do it, Mike.
So let's start off with the question about Moore's Law that's come up a few times with our publication. Some people are saying that Exascale is needed because Moore's Law is coming to an end. Do you agree with this? And what is the future of Moore's Law?
Well, I think there's some confusion about what Moore's Law says, and that leads to these assertions about what we need in terms of future HPC programs. When Gordon Moore, Intel's co-founder, described what later became known as Moore's Law, all he said was that the number of transistors on a chip would double. I think he probably said every 18 months, and then it eventually sort of stretched out to every 2 years. So his comment was strictly about the number of transistors per chip. When we started to see the doubling of performance with each generation of microprocessors, others started to redefine Moore's Law to mean, it's doubling of performance every couple of years. But in fact, Gordon never said that. I seem to recall, sometime in the 80s, hearing people refer to that doubling of performance as Joy's Law after Bill Joy from Berkeley, and then later from Sun Microsystems. But sort of that interpretation of Moore's Law, I think, pretty much became invalid early in the last decade, in the 2002 timeframe, when we started to see microprocessors not meeting that 2x kind of model. But in terms of transistor budgets, they continued to double, and in fact, the cadence was remarkably stable. Literally every 2 years, somebody would advance that, the technology at that rate. I think, when the issues, particularly with respect to power, began to limit things like clock frequency, that motivated us to start looking at multiple cores as a way to stay under the power budget, stay within the power budget, but increase performance. And I remember giving an IDF talk where I said, "Hey, you reduce the power about 10%, and I'm sorry, you reduce the frequency about 10%, and you can almost double the aggregate performance with two cores." And that's why Intel started delivering dual core machines and later quad cores. So. But you have to have the transistor budget to build all those cores, and that continues to be there. As far as the future goes, we're in production at 32 nanometer. We've shown 22 nanometer wafers, and 15 nanometers. Is not far behind that on the regular. On the regular cadence. So I just got an email, in fact, from one of our, technologists, process technologists, and it included a table that went out to 2022, in terms of projecting, Moore's Law. So, we're always good for about 10 years in terms of what we can see. We don't see any major, sort of disruptions to that schedule. Although, we're starting to look at what we call, post-charge electronics, where we start to look at other quantum effects as the operating principle. And, looking at spin torque transistors and graphene and, all kinds of sort of interesting new technologies, but I think out through the end of the decade, it's going to be silicon, CMOS, technology. Maybe a few new materials, but we'll have to see.
Okay. So you've got this window that takes you out there. Let's say, let's use 10 years as a round number. So you're obviously seeing exascale in some form or fashion, or at least the need for it at that point. If we look at what's going on in the United States right now, we've got the DARPA programs and the DOE programs that are the most visible. I don't know if there are any, as a matter of fact, other than those. But do you see those as collaborating, or do you see those as competitive in some way?
Oh, no. I think they're complementary. I guess I'd choose that that word to describe them. I think, you know, a good analogy here is you know, DARPA, consistent with its mission, you know, is sending out the scouts to, you know, to explore the, you know, the various ways west here. Since we're in Oregon, we can use the Lewis and Clark analogy, right? The scouts are out, you know, looking for, you know, for the you know, for the path to the Pacific, and you know, some of them won't make it. You know, some of them won't come back, but a few will, and that will, I think, provide you know, a much you know, stronger foundation on which to supply the needs of the Army, if you will. And I think, you know, DOE sort of is in that role. You know, they. You know, don't want to be running experiments so much. You know, they want to be able to, you know, buy machines and deploy machines that, you know, that have, you know, that have the performance characteristics and the reliability and power characteristics they want. So that's why I think the two are complementary. I mean, the two, you know, agencies, if you will, have, you know, have complementary roles, and I think they're fulfilling them.
Now, is Intel more tightly aligned with DOD at the UHPC program, or with DOE, or how, where do you guys sit right now?
Well, we're not under contract to the Department of Energy. At least I'm not aware of a specific DOE contract. We did, you know, announce a few months ago that that we had signed a technology agreement with DARPA for the UHPC program, or what, you know, DARPA describes as extreme scale systems. So we're definitely you know, we're definitely under a formal engagement with DOD through DARPA, and you know, I mean, we continue to talk to DOE, and certainly you know, in many of the, you know, the recent deployments, you know, Intel's been a major player.
Okay. So why has Intel decided to get back in, engaged in government programs at this level after what seems like a couple years of absence?
Well, I don't think we've been absent. You know, maybe we've just been quieter about it. You know, we've had government efforts in, you know, information security. In fact, fairly long-running effort in information security. More recently, our work in, you know, silicon-based optical communication, silicon photonics, has been sponsored in part by the government. So, you know, it's not that we've been in sort of, you know, zero government mode, and in fact, we would have participated in HPCS, but we were part of a couple of proposals that weren't picked. I think at that time there seemed to be quite a bias against commercial off the shelf technology, and you know, we are commercial off the shelf technology. So we got passed over in a couple of proposals. Had perhaps that bias not been there, we would have participated in HPCS. And you know, not to rub it in, but you know, if you look at Intel standing in the top 500, you know, we went from perhaps, you know, a few hundred machines to, you know, more than 400 machines in the top 500. So we were doing something right, even if we weren't, you know, we weren't funded by the government to do the research.
Good. Okay. So let's talk a little bit more specifically about exascale now. Mm-hmm. We're very aware of the announcements made with Intel's investments in exascale research labs in Europe specifically. Mm-hmm. Why Europe? Why? And the only emphasis that we've seen from Intel, per se, talking about exascale, has been about Europe up to this point. How does it mesh with what you're doing in the rest of the world, and why Europe?
Well, you know, I think the Europeans are taking quite a different approach, and there seems to be much more interest both at the EU level and at the individual country level. I mean, whether you're talking France or Germany or Belgium, whatever, in working collaboratively with companies. U.S. companies seem perfectly welcome there. So I think the climate in Europe is actually a bit different, or the sort of the attitude towards HPC and particularly exascale is a bit different. And we've thought those were good opportunities and entered into those lab arrangements. I mean, we'd be perfectly delighted to do that in the U.S., but there doesn't seem to be a similar opportunity. If anything, the various Department of Energy, Department of Defense, at least at HPC, have more of a kind of an arm's length arrangement, and the sort of notion of having a joint lab is just not something that seems to play well in the U.S.
Okay. So, regarding exascale strategy on Intel's behalf, who owns it? Do you own it?
Well, I think it's actually pretty pretty simple. Intel Labs has the research responsibility. We're the people that are responsible for performing under the under the UHPC program, and demonstrating the technology that we propose to develop. And we have other research efforts that we view as part of extreme scale computing that are not necessarily funded as part of UHPC. And in fact, I think were it not for those programs, we probably wouldn't have been in a position to make as strong a proposal as we were able to make. Development responsibility, when we get to that point of actually building full up systems, is part of the data center group under Kirk Skaugen. Raj Hazara heads the HPC program for Kirk, and those guys have product responsibility. And like in any big company, there's a lot of arguing and debating about the issues. But I think I think that's actually a good thing. I think that you need that kind of tension, I think, if you're really going to get the best result. I mean, if everybody just sort of rolled over either way, just let the researchers define it or let the developers define it, we probably wouldn't get the best result. And ultimately, we're trying to do the best for our shareholders, and so that a bit of creative tension is healthy. I know that that from time to time confuses people on the on the outside, but I think largely we're able to sit down and explain what's going on.
Great answer. I like that. Okay, so you saw the announcement today's paper about China. We've had several articles that we've published. excuse me, where we've had one person anonymously who's commented from China on some of the work that's going on there. And in the first article, he even said, we fully expect the first working exascale system to have a tag on it that says made in China. Mm-hmm. What's your perspective on this?
Well, I think the speculation may be a bit premature. Exascale is a very hard problem. As I've told the panel that Al Trivelpiece ran for DOE, the exascale panel, you know, this is not like getting from teriscale to petascale. You know, this is really hard. You know, we're not getting anywhere near the kind of free ride we got on, you know, on the back of commercial technology to get to, you know, to get to petascale. So, you know, talking about, you know, well, you know, these people are going to be first or those people, you know, I mean, you know, right now I can't tell you we know how to do it, right? And I probably would have made, if we were, you know, if we were doing this, you know, this interview, you know, some years back and talking about when we might get to petascale, you know, I probably would have had more confidence than I have sitting here today. So that's one thing. You know, I also think that, you know, the question, you have to separate the question between, you know, who's going to deliver the technology and who's going to write the check. And, you know, I think, you know, I mean, ultimately, who's going to have that first machine is going to be a function of who's writing the check. And, you know, the Chinese, you know, will certainly be in a position to write the check if they choose. The U.S. could certainly write the check, you know, if it decided to write the check, and the Europeans could do so as well. So, it, you know, this becomes a question of political will, I think, more than technology, assuming you can get the technology there. But, you know, it's hard for me to imagine an exascale system that doesn't depend in some fundamental way on U.S. technology. I mean, there are just so many aspects of exascale system design that today and for the foreseeable future will depend fundamentally on technology developed here in the U.S.
Okay. So do you think we need a national exascale initiative?
Well, not exactly. How's that for an answer? No, I say that actually in all seriousness. You know, you say a national initiative, and you know, you hear, you know, Kennedy, you know, and we're putting a man on the moon, and you know, and bringing him safely back to Earth, and you know, or you know, you've got the president, you know, I guess Roosevelt, you know, commissioning the Manhattan Project to build a bomb. I think those kinds of national initiatives are different in the sense that they had a very specific goal, and once the goal had been achieved, we were done, right? And everybody could go sort of back to whatever they were, what they were doing. HPC is not like that. You know, this is the never-ending story, and you have to understand that. There'll never be a point where we'll say we have enough computing power, or you know, hey, these machines are fast enough. You know, we don't need to go any faster than this. So that really suggests we've got a different kind of problem than a man on the moon or you know, atomic bomb kind of problem, and different, you know, different tactics need to be employed. I suggested, you know, years ago, and I'm not the only one who made this suggestion, that we view HPC much like we view, you know, military aircraft, if you will. You know, we don't expect that, you know, the aerospace and defense companies will just go off and design, you know, Mach, you know, 3 stealth fighter aircraft and then see if they can find a buyer for it, right? The government pays the whole ticket. And in fact, interestingly, the government will start a couple of programs and fund them to a point where they've got operational aircraft and they'll have a fly-off. And they'll do all sorts of evaluation of the aircraft and then they'll pick one and they'll fund that one to production. You know, given that the market for, you know, the capability machines, you know, the very top of the line HPC systems is probably smaller than the military aircraft market, one would think that we would use, you know, a similar approach and that we wouldn't expect HPC companies to, you know, constantly be sort of betting the business that, you know, that they're going to win they're going to win a few sales. So that's one approach. And I've never gotten a good answer from either, you know, the folks at Defense or the folks at Energy as to why, you know, we don't do that. But given the challenge of exascale, and given the relatively poor health of the HPC industry, maybe it's time to switch into that mode. The other alternative, which was my theme at last year's supercomputing conference, was let's find a high volume application for HPC technology and let it drive the investment and let the government just sort of siphon off the best of that technology to build exascale systems. And I said that application, I mean, the obvious one to me is 3D web. I mean, where everybody in the web is essentially in the middle of, you know, a large scale, multi-dimensional, simulation, that will drive the need for computing power to levels even beyond exascale. Certainly if you have to deliver that for a few billion people on the planet. I never heard one word, not a positive comment or a negative comment from either DOD or DOE about that, and yet I know those guys were all in the first 10 rows at SC09, right? And in fact, you know, a few of them kind of hustled past me, you know, like, oh, well, yeah, we're not going to deal with that. I really think, this may be a case of the emperor has no clothes. I mean, this is not a healthy industry. You don't see a lot of venture capital money coming into HPC. When you look at the books of the players with the exception, you know, someone like IBM, who's sort of, a much bigger entity. But if you look at the pure plays in HPC, those guys are just hanging on. And I wish the government agencies here in the U.S. in particular would stop kidding themselves that somehow they can just keep playing the same tune, you know, sort of decade after decade, and expect that that these companies will put themselves through that same agony over and over again. So, take your choice. Either it looks like weapon systems development, or we find a high volume application. But the definition of insanity is doing the same thing again and again and expecting a different result. And we may be in that situation today.
That's very interesting. Yeah, from my perspective, I see a fair amount. I talk to almost all the startups, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But I see a lot of companies coming along, and they realize that they realize that their revenue future, being an HPC player, requires them to go down market, mm-hmm. Right? Hit that middle market, so forth. So they're all looking for a solution to take something that's kind of cutting edge, whatever the level of the solution is that they bring to the table, and put it down there. They're not doing research at this end because they can't. They're trying to survive.
Mm-hmm.
That leaves the research to the Intels and the IBMs and so forth to go off and figure out how to do that, which to me is a very dangerous situation, that you've got some of this incredibly bright talent that could be some very hot spots that we need for exascale development, but they can't contribute. Do you think that would be fixed in a situation where there's more government funding?
Well, absolutely. I think this is a risk reward scenario, what you just described, and whether you're playing with your own money or you're playing with other people's money, I think the issue is pretty much the same. And so I guess I was actually thinking about it somewhat differently. I was thinking about it from a programming point of view, right? You know, where are the bright young programmers today? Well, they're not working in HPC, right? They're writing apps for Android and iOS 4, right? I mean, that's what they're doing, mm-hmm. right? Because it's a high volume opportunity, and boy, you get a successful app out there for one of the smartphones, and you can be a small businessman in a big hurry. So there's very little to attract the best and the brightest, I think, that are coming out of schools today to this area. And unless we find a stable predictable, robust way to fund the ongoing research, it's increasingly going to be a problem of just not having the talent around to make these breakthroughs. They'll be off, with some cool device that you hold in your hand, or something for your car, or something in your in your family room, for 3D entertainment, something of that sort.
When we were going down that road to teraflops, which I remember very well, we used to always talk about the grand challenges of science. And maybe they're overused, or maybe we just got tired of them. But the people that I talk to don't seem to get excited anymore when you talk about some grand challenge. What do we need to do to get people excited about the possibilities of what we can do with exascale?
Well, yeah, I think maybe grand challenge just got used too much, right? I think maybe the term got exhausted. Some of these terms are like that, right? After you've used them for a decade or two, right? It's kind of hard to keep describing things as grand challenge. It gets back to what I said earlier, that high performance computing is this never ending challenge, and it's always going to be difficult to continue justifying investment on the basis of, there are these big challenges out there. In fact, the scale of the challenges change, but the kinds of challenges seem very similar. I mean, we're still talking about physics and chemistry and more and more biology or microbiology or brain function. We've been talking about those same things for decades, and I'm sure when the folks go up on the hill to talk about these things, at least the members, the staffers, and maybe the congressmen and senators are going, wow, this sounds familiar. Weren't you guys here 7 or 8 years ago with this same song? So I think it's all part of this problem that I was describing, that we really haven't framed this in such a way that people understand and are motivated to make this ongoing investment, and that's why I think it gets more and more difficult each cycle. At least back in the in the 70s and the early part of the 80s, we had the Cold War that drove a lot of this, but with that increasingly a distant memory, we don't seem to have that one thing that really touches us both as individuals and as a as a nation, if you will, that says, hey, we've got to do this work because our national security and our economic security depends on it.
So a lot of people consistently say we can't get to exascale without some level of international collaboration. And we have the IESP and so forth working on the X-Stack. Do you agree that there needs to be a certain level of international collaboration?
I would be kidding you if I said no, because in fact, if you look at our internal research effort, it's global, we've felt for a long, long time that you have to tap into the best people you can find wherever they are on the planet, and if that's in China, it's in China. If it's in India, if it's in Europe, it's in Europe, and we're in all of those places and others. In Russia. So, it's just a going in assumption that it's going to involve an international effort, and particularly I think on the In the programming area, where the capital investments are not nearly so intensive, you know, there's tremendous opportunity and value to be gained by approaching it as an international problem. You know, that doesn't change my view of how we look at things here in the in the U.S. But it's hard to imagine an exascale effort that doesn't have an international dimension to it.
And obviously, Intel has been doing international development for many, many years. But when you look at an exascale effort and you realize that at some point in time, it comes down to just what we saw in the newspaper today. It comes down to bragging rights. And does that collaboration, as we get closer to reaching some achievable goal that we can talk about or brag about, start to fall into competition? And does that break everything up? And what happens then? I'd just like you to look a few years ahead and give us your thoughts.
Well, I we do both, I guess, what we'd call pre-competitive and competitive kinds of research, and we're more than happy in pre-competitive phase to involve other people. I mean, whether it's other companies or the academy, all of them are welcome. I think you're right. I mean, as we get closer to defining, you know, the specific products, then we look more like a multinational corporation. I see the pre-competitive, excuse me, I see the pre-competitive phase as being longer here because of the nature of the challenge, and therefore the opportunity is greater to work cooperatively around the planet to do those sorts of things. And when you're talking about capital intensive sorts of things like building chip factories and making mask sets to run products through them and all of that, that's when things start to change. But I think in terms of applications, programming models, even I think to a certain degree, architecture, and maybe even getting down to the logic and circuit level, we can use all the help we can get. Yes, at some point, everybody will sort of take those learnings and go back to their countries and their companies and decide what to do. But I think they'll be better for having collaborated and cooperated than were they to not do so.
Okay. So the last two questions I have, we didn't really prep you on these, so if you can't answer these or don't want to, that's fine. One, I'd like to ask you about how many people does Intel employ worldwide that are involved at some level in exascale research?
Oh, wow. That is a number I'm probably going to have to... it's certainly in the hundreds. It's sort of how far do you extend that ring? I mean, as soon as you sort of, I think, move... into the semiconductor technology, the process technology, device technology domain, then that number goes way up.
Sure.
But I think if you're assuming that, and then starting at sort of circuits and logic and going up, the rest of the way in the stack, it's in the hundreds. I don't have the.
Would you have the exact number. Do you think is that a proprietary number of some sort?
I don't know if it's proprietary.
No. We can get that.
Yeah, we can probably give you an estimate.
Okay. Right. The reason I want to address that one, if we can, is I had a comment from someone recently that said, there's a few recs out there to hire exascale research level people, but really nobody's really hiring for exascale yet. My point was, well, there's literally hundreds of people already working in it. They're not yet. Of course there are.
Well, yeah,
Until you cut it.
Yeah, it depends. Right, it's all subject to the definition of of that. Mm-hmm. But when I look at Intel, look at what's going on in the labs, and what's going on within the data center group, on HPC in general, on Exascale in particular, and then when I look at what's going on in software and solutions mm-hmm. group, which is more focused on the applications, that's yeah. hundreds of people.
Do you think 2018 is a realistic, a valid time frame for us actually reaching one of these systems? Achieving it?
I think it's doable, right? I think it's conceivable that that something could be stood up in that time frame, that would measure out at a sustained exaflops. But there's a lot of work to do, and there are a lot of really tough problems to overcome. We're talking about basically a 300x improvement over at the systems level in terms of energy efficiency over Jaguar. I don't have the numbers from the new machine in China, but to achieve a 300x improvement in basically the next 8 years is a tough problem. And if we could make order of magnitude improvements in flops per watt, in bits per watt, thinking about memory, or bits per second per watt, if you want to think about it that way, in packets per second per watt, to cover mm-hmm. communication, in the efficiencies of the power systems and the cooling systems, I think we'd all be ecstatic. And yet, people are asking for 30x that number, right? That's what makes it such a tough problem. Not impossible, but very, very hard. And, when people start talking about doing it this decade, I think they have to understand that you're talking about a huge improvement from where we are. And we're not getting, as I said earlier, we're not getting the sort of the historical bumps that we used to get from the underlying chip technology. Bigger transistor budgets, but power has become such an overriding consideration that that we have to be extremely clever about design. Somebody asked me, what are the three biggest problems with Exascale? And I said, power. Now, there are a lot of other things. I mean, reliability and programmability and everything like that. But, just being able to build one of these things and not throw in a nuclear reactor with each one sort of describes the problem.
So flash forward to like 2018 or 2020, mm-hmm. the operation power requirement aside, you walk in the computer room, there's the system, and it goes as far as you can see or whatever. Mm-hmm. There's a price tag hanging on the side. What did it cost to put it together?
Oh, wow. I think it really, the size of that price tag really depends on whether the technology that enabled it had a broad use or had only that specific use, right? And and we've been debating that in HPC circles for decades, and I think we've seen over the last several decades that the broad use technologies invariably win because nobody has deep enough pockets to pay for the whole thing, right? I've told my management that our interest in exascale, or actually I think here's the case, our interest is in extreme scale technologies, is that they potentially have broad benefit to the computing industry, right? You know, I would like, you know, my smartphone circa 2018, if you will, you know, to, you know, have 100 gigaflops of capability for doing some amazing set of perceptual computing tasks, context-aware kinds of, you know, kinds of things. That phone will need more or less the same tech to do that. That phone will need more or less the same technology that the biggest machine we can afford will employ. But the fact that it'll be going out in hundreds of millions, if not billions, of consumer devices will amortize the cost, to a degree that the price tag hanging on the big machine will look affordable, right? I won't speculate on exactly what it'll be, but unless there are other volume applications for the technology, I think it'll probably be too steep for just about anybody to afford, and you know, and that would be, I think, as big a disaster having not doing it at all.
Couldn't agree more. So we just have a few minutes left, maybe 5 minutes or so. Did you want to cover anything specific? Did you want to talk about the announcement from China today, the HPC side, or anything?
No, I didn't have any specific comment about China. I haven't really been able to, to study it in all that much depth. I think we actually touched on. Let's see, we did that.
You called everything in this.
Almost word for word. That was
pretty good.
Yeah, we talked about weapons system. We talked about funding.
Did you want to chat at all about the semantics of extreme scale versus exascale?
Well, we can say more. It was the line I was just pursuing. Mm-hmm. Particularly in energy efficiency, I think we've picked most of the low-hanging fruit. Okay. So, I mean, the fact that we can get as much computing power as we can, you know, now into a device that, basically runs all day, you know, not a week, but runs all day, that says something. But, where's the next order of magnitude of energy efficiency going to come from? And to me, that's an extreme scale problem. You know, where's the next order of magnitude and performance going to come from? That's an extreme scale problem. And I don't care whether you're talking about, you know, something you hold in the hand, something that, you know, goes in the, goes in your car, something that sits next to your desk. I mean, you can just continue to scale it up. They're all going to be facing those same issues. Both energy efficiency and performance, and the same reliability concerns, the same security concerns, and so forth. So, I think we're challenged by this notion of extreme scale. You know, how do we get that next order of magnitude or two, mm-hmm. In all of these, critical. Areas, and to me, having exascale as a driver is wonderful, but it's sort of necessary but not sufficient, right? There has to be more going on here, to do it, and I think extreme scale is the perspective that suddenly opens up all of these additional market opportunities for you, because everybody's going to be clamoring, right? Hey, I don't want this thing just to run for a day. I want it to run for a week. And by the way, it gets too hot when I hold it in my hand. And by the way, my text messages are all getting relayed to, some kid in Armenia. All of those issues we view as extreme scale issues, and they need to be solved in any case. And the fact that they can serve exascale, I think, is just kind of the plum on top.